If you're wondering how to navigate government or grow your business or even secure funding for your nonprofit, then this is the podcast for you. Here on Lobbying Insider, we take a look at the intersection between business and government and show how things actually get done. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Welcome to the program. And we are joined today by Sky Ostreicher, who is an influencer in politics here in New York. Sky, great to have you.
Thank you for having me, Zach.
I wanted to talk to you just a little bit about what you do and kind of the changing nature of the media landscape here in New York City and New York State. Tell me just a little bit about being an influencer in politics and how that works. What are the kinds of things you focus on?
So, you know, I began my journey really going to medical school. That's how I began this.
And it not the first thing I would have thought of. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was at University of Miami. I had a full scholarship. And Donna Shalala was the president of the school. She was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Health and Human Services when he was president. So she taught a course about working for the president. And she brought him in as a guest speaker to class. And together, Bill Clinton and Donna Shalala told the story of the night that she was his designated survivor during his State of the Union address.
Yeah, that is basically there. One person, and depends on the line of succession, has to be the designated. And depending on who's out of the country or whatever else, it goes down the line, right?
Yep. So I didn't know anything about politics at the time. I was a pre-med student. But that story, I was like, wow, forget about medical school. This is so much more interesting. So I'm going to graduate a year early and study health policy. So I came back to Long Island. I did my master's in public health at Stony Brook, which turned into a second master's in public policy because it was only one more semester worth of classes because there was a lot of overlap. And then I was 22 with two master's degrees, and I said, let me do something fun before I dive into health policy work. So I interned at News 12 Long Island.
I remember them, yes. They're still around, in fact.
And this was in, yes, in 2013. You're going to like this one. It was Ed Mangano was the Nassau County executive.
Yeah, I remember.
And Tom Suozzi was running for his seat back.
Okay.
And I went on the scene with Shari Einhorn from News 12 Long Island. And I was there and I had to interview Ed and Tom. And Ed wouldn't get on camera. And Tom did. And I really liked what Tom had to say. I liked the way he spoke. I liked his sound bites. He sounded good. He seemed like a nice person.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about politics or government, but I liked his personality.
Yeah, middle of the road guy too.
I liked him.
Yeah.
So I reached out to his campaign and I said, you know, how can I get involved? Like, can we host a party at the house? Like, Mom and Dad, can we host a party at the house? And they're like, sure. Like, they weren't into politics either.
Yeah.
So it's always been about personality that drives me. I'm a people person. I say I studied chemistry in college, but now my work is still in chemistry. It's in human chemistry. It's organic chemistry. It's feeling people out. And the way that that's played out in government is really you have to have both sides of the aisle to get something done, you know? And you can see that people fight on screen or in person or on the floor, but behind the scenes, they're friends. They can get along. They can have a drink. They can make fun of one another. They can support one another. They can go to each other's kids' birthday parties, but you don't see that when you're just focused on legislation and public policy.
Right. And it always used to be that way. I think it's gotten worse. I think the partisanship has increased in the last 30 years, I would argue. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. But yes, it used to be very congenial. You still have elements of it. I certainly see it in Albany, where both sides of the aisle can get along and share a joke and whatever else.
Definitely. So I like to showcase that. And it was during the pandemic I started doing these interviews, my political personalities interview series. Everyone was in lockdown. You couldn't go to a cocktail party to meet who was running. This was in 2021 now, during that big race with the 35 out of 51 city council members were term limited. We had a new mayor coming in, new district attorneys, new borough presidents, but you couldn't go meet them. We were in lockdown. So I did all these Zoom interviews. And in races where there was a nine-way primary for different Democrats, it's like, what makes this Democrat different than this Democrat? Let's just talk about who you are as a person.
Right. Because the policies are very often indistinguishable.
Uh-huh.
Right? Very often you ask them what their position is on something, and it's you can't tell the difference between all the candidates.
So it came down to how I felt about the person and their personality.
Yeah.
So then I...
And voters vote on both, right? I mean, there was always... I mean, you just go back to something like the 2000 election with Al Gore and his national, obviously. Al Gore and George W. Bush, and everyone was saying, well, who would you rather have a beer with? And most people answered George W. Bush.
Right, yeah. And that was then. And now, like, that would be a trending video on TikTok, right? Going around and asking, who would you rather have a beer with?
Yeah.
You know? And that plays into how you brought this up is, like, the media landscape has changed. The way that we interact with each other, forget about government, the way we interact with each other has changed. People DM each other memes and videos and send things that they feel would relate to someone else.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, my high school friends who we talk every single day where we send each other videos, something funny. We don't ever actually have a conversation. And, you know, I have no idea what's going on in their lives.
This is how people keep in touch, by sending each other funny things on the internet.
There you go. It's a bond in and of itself, right?
So
we do share the humor. So.
And then it's like, government is not fun. It's not fun. People don't understand government. It's not the same. It's not the same dynamic. It's like there's lots of rules and laws and codes and legislation. And when you go look at a bill, it's like in ye old English with the way it's explained. Like you really can't figure it out. So I look at it like, how do we loosen up government a little bit? How do we figure out, how do we help our electeds? They got to talk to the private sector. You got to bridge that gap by making organizations feel that they can get to know elected officials. And I love learning about the political personalities. Like, I got a tattoo with Councilmember Chiosei. I rode on the back of a garbage truck with Assemblyman Mike Durso because he was a sanitation worker for 15 years.
Yeah.
Senator Natalia Fernandez told me the story of how she was born at home. Her father helped deliver her in the bathroom. Like, they share these human stories, and it's like it sticks with you in a way that their legislative platform wouldn't necessarily stick with you.
Right, and bill language, to your point, is very often feels like it's by design exclusionary, right? It's not very accessible to the general public. And there's, I guess, value in that and just the sort of Albany speak and keeping it to the handful of experts. But politics is so much more than that. And is your sense that it's moving in more in the direction of what you're talking about?
I mean, we just saw in this mayoral primary, Zoran was an unknown candidate months prior. And because of what he did, he met the voters where they are. He met them online.
Right.
He made funny videos. He's charismatic. He smiles. He looks at the camera. And he won the hearts of so many that came out and voted for him. A lot of 25% of those people that came out and voted for him had never voted before. He inspired people to come out and vote for him.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. He changed the map because you really have seen in the last two mayoral elections, both the Bill de Blasio and Eric Adams really drew from kind of the same base, you know, kind of people outside of Manhattan, for example, middle class voters, and Zoran Mamdani changed that map for the first time in a very long time and brought out new voters. I mean, you know, for example, he's a Muslim. There are 750,000 Muslims now in New York as part of the electorate. I mean, that's a huge swath of the population that is just evolving and changing and growing.
And I would say it really has to do with the way that he utilized social media. You don't see that with the other candidates. I mean, I won't throw anyone under the bus, but there are videos out there that are really not engaging, right? And they're, you know.
No, we should speak candidly. I mean, I don't want you to insult anybody, but I mean, they're, it is kind of to your point, and you don't want to ever say somebody can't do something, right? But it is a little bit of a young person's game. I mean, I do think the familiarity with the technology, the understanding of how to utilize that technology effectively, beginning with the fact that it resonates better with younger people who are also on TikTok. Mm-hmm. I don't have TikTok on my phone. I'm a Generation X person, but my daughter does. You know, she's 12.
And this is how most people...
By the way, I probably shouldn't let her have TikTok. I probably shouldn't have just said that out loud, but just, you know, don't judge me as a parent. She'd be really upset if I didn't let her have it.
But this is, you know, this is how people are consuming information now. This is how people are getting their news, especially young people. This is how they communicate. This is how they get their information. So if government isn't there and everyone else is, then government falls further and further behind. And now we can even talk about technology in government.
Mm-hmm. And in other words, that is, in terms of reaching people, it's changing?
In terms of, I have this whole theory, should I really
dive
into this?
Yeah.
That Gen Xers are phasing out towards the end of, when you look at a government job, there's way more millennials. I just saw something online that
said, Gen X is the smallest of all of them, right? It's
small, you know, generation, yeah, millennial, yeah, bigger generation, yeah. And there are more millennial managers now than ever before. We're the generation that we are CEOs, we're in public office, millennials. Yeah. We are the first generation to have grown up with social media.
Right. Because we did not. We became aware of it and figured out how to use it, but we definitely did not have this when we were growing up.
So now, when you go work in government, if government is behind the times on all their technological systems, that doesn't attract a millennial to want to work in government. And if government decides, okay, we're going to get everyone the iPhone 16, by the time they RFP it and procure it and it processes, they get the iPhone 16, but we're up to iPhone 27 by then.
Right.
So how do you keep government competitive? We gotta find other ways to integrate new technology into government, and I think it begins with social media content creation.
And is your sense that this is becoming increasingly more important, not just in campaigns, but in the governance itself, in other
Completely.
Words?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, if you go up to anyone, you ask them, do you know what DCAS does? You know, do you know what this agency does? Do you know how this government agency works? People don't really understand. Most people don't even know that there are 51 council members and the youngest one was elected at age 23. People don't get it. But if it was more accessible, if it was bite-sized, if it was explained in a simple way, I think we'd have a lot more of an engaged electorate, especially when you're looking at millennials and younger who grew up with social media.
Were some of the older, you know, people within the electorate who are used to voting in primaries, do you think they were taken aback or caught off guard by, you know, not only the social media that they may not have been, you know, you said Zora Mamdani's making all these videos that are getting high visibility. I think you're absolutely right. But I feel like there's a big portion of the population that just didn't even see them.
Right. And those are, I guess, your mainstream voters, the people that answer
traditionally
the door.
Vote. Yeah.
Traditional voters.
Right, right. Older voters.
I was going to say the elder statesmen. Older's
not bad.
Of New York
City. I mean, it just is, right?
Those are people that check their mail.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a mail key.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
I don't have a mail key. Everything's done online. Every once in a while, I'll get some
You don't have a landline
spam
either,
mail.
Do you?
No, I don't have a landline.
Yeah.
Do you have a landline?
I do have a landline, I don't ever use it, but I do technically have a landline.
But even daylight savings isn't a thing anymore. Remember setting the clocks back?
Yeah.
You don't have to set your clock back now because you use a phone, it automatically updates. You use your computer, the time automatically updates.
I think the whole concept of daylight savings is pretty annoying, frankly. But, you know, but you're right. You don't have to physically do it.
But anyway, so you're looking at the younger generation that consumes information on social media and communicates that way. Yes, that's good for campaigns, but it's also good for government. People in government office, people that work in government agencies to understand and a back and forth of how does this stuff work? Don't you want to explain it and consume it? And yes, there are the older voters that are used to being, you know, a double prime voter and checking their mailbox and doing things the right way, showing up to vote on election day. So you got to cater to all the audiences right now.
I know in Albany, the struggle very often is to exactly what you're talking about, try and reach people about the programs that are available to them, because very often where they fall short, they'll pass legislation that could actually help people if they knew about it, if they knew how to access it, if they knew where to access it. And it seems like that's a big challenge, because how do you reach people where they are and get them to utilize programs that can actually benefit them financially or otherwise?
Yes. And the government needs to do a better job of communicating those things. I like to quote Senator Kevin Parker, who said that as an elected, his knowledge is a mile wide, but only an inch thick.
Yeah.
So unless people from the private sector are coming to him even to help inform legislation and to communicate to him and help him communicate to his constituents, that's the other side of the coin. Yes, government needs to communicate to the people, and the people and businesses need to communicate back to government.
Right. No, that's essential.
I know we just went, that was like a big tangent, but anyway, that's what I like doing as a political social media influencer. I like to consider myself a storyteller, and it's because I've had the honor of building human relationships with a lot of our government leaders and then with a lot of the organizations that are in those orbits. And then people come to me with a lot of information about different events and parties and gatherings and conferences and places to be and things to go do. And then I'm looked at as this person that shows up with the microphone. I can talk to anyone. I'm never going to put anyone on the spot or make them look badly.
Right.
And I'm going to post about it online. And there aren't a lot of people posting about government behind the scenes online in a consumable way.
You're not playing gotcha. You're not trying to trip people up or anything like that. I would say what you do is unique in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously there are influencers who are out there covering politics, engaging with politicians. But at least in New York, I think you're a real trailblazer in that sense.
Thank you.
So what has the reaction been? I mean, are people skeptical initially? I'm sure there's a bit of a learning curve where people say, you know, they might be used to dealing with traditional media. I mean, I know just from dealing with the politicians over a year, they all have kind of a hierarchy of who they want to talk to in the media. You know, it starts with the New York Times, and if that doesn't work out, I'll go to the New York Post, or then I'll go to, you know, Channel 4 or whatever like that. I mean, what you do is kind of a different thing.
Yeah, it's totally different because it's storytelling, and it's all evergreen. It's anything that's happening, and it's storytelling. And I don't think I know what you mean about trusting a reporter and building that rapport. I think that my reputation now has been established as someone that's never going to put someone in a bad light or ask a gotcha question.
Right. No, it's complementary on both ends, right? Your work is better when it's not like that.
Correct.
Yeah. Because certainly with reporters, there's a different gender. And I do want to talk a little bit about kind of legacy media and what has been happening with all of that, because I think it's been somewhat overlooked, or at least the media itself is not very self-critical. They're not always very good at looking in the mirror and seeing what they did wrong. But, you know, you look at the national election last year with Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and it just felt like the media was kind of missing the story, you know, and wasn't really understanding what was going on here. And I think there's been a recalibration on the part of the national networks and the national papers and everything. But I think we have a great example we can talk about right here, which you mentioned regarding the mayoral primary. I mean, it does feel as though there was this assumption that the front runner, who the former governor, would walk away with this. And there were polls that were obviously either wrong or evolving, and it does feel like that there was a rush to judgment, and it turns out that judgment was incorrect.
I think that we are living in a world where everything is changed. Everything has changed
very quickly. Also, right. It's not a gradual change. It feels like someone hit a light switch.
Yeah, I mean, look at ChatGPT.
Yeah.
That explosion of knowledge that now everyone uses. I can't imagine being a student and having access to ChatGPT to do my homework, write my essays, and so on.
Right, right. And it makes a huge difference.
How are teachers even grading these materials?
Yeah, well, I know the teachers don't want kids using it. And that's also very hard to police, right? I mean, something like that.
Yes.
And if the technology's there, it's almost like telling a kid, you know, when you get to college level or math, for example, you can't use a calculator. Like, of course you can use a calculator, uh-huh. Right? Life is never going to present a circumstance
where
you cannot.
You're not going to have access to
right.
it. Exactly.
So it actually makes more sense to teach with the new technologies as they evolve.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, back to media specifically.
Yes.
You know from your work at New York One, being a reporter, it used to be you would go out and get the story, come back, work on it, edit it, and then you would have a deadline and it's released then to the public. Now, anyone with an iPhone can share the story in real time. And sometimes there's misinformation. And a lot of times everyone's a journalist now. You can be an independent storyteller, but the point is you got to tell it faster, and in real time.
And that was sort of, you know, happening with Twitter, meaning that it became a race to get stuff out faster than everybody else. It was highly competitive. But it was, you know, you still did your traditional stories, which took time to gather, you know.
Right.
I mean, one of the big revelations for me when, you know, I would spend, you know, hours in a day driving to the far reaches of the five boroughs doing interviews with people, mm-hmm. you know, and getting them on camera. You know, this guy's in Southeast Queens, this other person's up in the Bronx. And then honestly, with the pandemic, when it became, well, we can just do it over Zoom, you know, that became a real time saver, you know, right. It was less of a time suck driving all over the five boroughs. So that changed it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was circumstantial, I guess.
Yeah. Like I just watched the Barbara Walters documentary, and one of the things she's credited with is the exclusive interview with Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
When Bill Clinton was president.
This was 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the documentary, they say that to this day is the number one watched interview of all time because she got the exclusive and it aired at 7 p.m. And that was the one and only time that everyone in America, 70 million people, tuned in, because that was the one and only time they could view it.
Right.
That would never happen today.
No. No, it would not. And there were also fewer channels, right? Fewer outlets. I mean, the only other comparable thing, I guess, would be something like the Super Bowl, which is a one-time event. It's live. You get very big audiences, but not, you know, for anything else, not quite like that. 70 million people, I mean, that's like unheard of.
So that's like a moment in history that'll just exist forever because right. The media landscape has completely changed.
Right. And do you think that the people you interact with in politics, they seem aware of that? I mean, are they less concerned, in your opinion, just from talking to people, are they less concerned, becoming less concerned with traditional media?
Are people becoming
politicians? Do you get the sense that they are realizing that the world is changing, that they don't have to worry necessarily about journalism the same way that they used to, that people are consuming media differently?
Well, I think, and I'm interested in your opinion about this too, but if there's a story or there's a negative story, you can correct that now. You can get on camera right in that moment and correct it, or tell your side of the story, or do anything on social media to narrate around that story if there's a story that someone views was, you know, shining a negative light upon them.
Right.
But I think that the more transparent that our government officials are and agency leaders and anyone for that matter, the more transparent you are and active online and communicating what you're doing, I think the more human you present yourself in that manner, then the more likely you are to be able to build relationships within this community. And I think there's been maybe a hurdle in doing this with government because of all the rules, regulations, compliance, and then different questions within government. Then the political atmosphere. If I say this, what are my colleagues going to think of that? How are people going to view me? How are my constituents going to view me? Am I going to get reelected? And it's, you got to, you know, what is the speaker going to think of this? What is the mayor going to think of this? You always have to watch your back.
Yeah.
Right? So I think now in the age of social media, it encourages people to actually be more honest and forthcoming, but there's risk with that too.
Right, right. But at the end of the day, it's probably a net benefit because it's relatability.
And if you are who you are, you can tell. You can tell when someone's BSing you or being honest.
Right. And I do think that is a lot of what was going on with the mayoral election. I mean, it does look as though the candidate who was most out there, Zoran Mamdani, won by a sizable margin. And the candidates who either avoided the press or were not able to get press in the same way themselves, you know, suffered at the polls. You know, and there was a lot of people in the race who didn't have very strong name recognition, and Mamdani was able to really get his name out there, which I think made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. He presents change, right? He looks at just a very different candidate than we're all used to, than we all have heard of before. Basically, everyone knows Eric Adams, everyone knows Andrew Cuomo, and everyone knows Curtis Sliwa, who's run, you know, as a Republican before. No one really knew Zoran. He presents something fresh, young, 33, exciting, different, wild. And then the haters come out in droves, too, to attack him. And I think that encourages his base even more. Like, yeah, that's my guy. Everyone's mad at him.
But it's interesting because, yes, you're right. He was a relative, you know, unknown. He's an assemblyman, been around for just a few years. I think he won in 2020. He was relatively new in Albany. But you had other people in the race who were also relatively unknown who didn't break through, you know, in the same way. Someone like Zelnor Myrie, very likable guy, very interesting guy, very ambitious. He's going places without a doubt, but it didn't quite have the same influence in terms of what he was capable of doing in terms of his reach. I mean, was it, you think it was the social media element that really sort of propelled Zoran Mamdani beyond his own obvious, you know, attributes as a candidate himself, because he is so charming and likable?
Yes, I think that because of the way he was able to communicate with his audience, and yes, he garnered supporters. He has 34,000 volunteers, you know, it's the whole network of things, but just looking at from a social media perspective alone, I think he was the best at that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You had an upcoming event you wanted to talk about as well?
Oh, yes. Okay. Now, since I'm in the industry of making politics fun and humanizing our elected officials, the event that this is our second annual, it's called Style Across the Aisle. Elected officials model the runway wearing designers from their districts. Last year was the inaugural year. We did it at Gracie Mansion. This year we're doing it at Surrogates Court downtown. We have 35 different models, both sides of the political aisle, all areas of local government, and they're going to be elevating local New York City designers. And the whole purpose is to feel-good community engagement fashion show.
And you found that the there's not any partisan politics there or anything?
People How are can
eager
there
to,
be?
Eager to work together? And
we can agree that someone looks good in that outfit. It's that simple.
I don't know. It's subjective, Sky. I got, you know, some people look better than others.
I think, right, sports is a unifier. You like that team. I like that team. Let's right. be friends. I think fashion is a unifier as well. Music, fashion.
Yeah. No, it certainly can be. So, yeah. So you have electeds who are participating in some of the same ones from last year?
Yeah, some of the same ones from last year. A whole bunch of new ones from the city council, state senate, state assembly, some commissioners, a deputy mayor. And we're fundraising for a nonprofit called Witness to Mass Incarceration. They have a program in Queens where they teach fashion school, fashion manufacturing to formerly incarcerated and or currently homeless kids.
That's a great cause. How did you get involved with that?
All through my web of a brain. You know, yeah. I'm connected to this one, connected to this one. We're doing the event at Surrogates Court, so there's an element of justice there. Then I had a meeting with Borough President Donovan Richards. I mentioned fashion. He mentions the art of tailoring, Witness to Mass Incarceration. I go there. I meet these kids and this woman, Evie Litwak, who runs the organization. She was formerly incarcerated. She started this nonprofit. It's funded by the Federal Department of Justice. They could use some more local relationships in government. I asked them, have you ever heard of Eddie Gibbs, the first formerly incarcerated elected official in New York State? No, they've never met him. We set that up, and there, those kids are going to be creating an outfit for Eddie to wear down the runway on September 10th.
Oh, that's great. I bet he's going to love it. So how do you game out the mayor's race? Do you anticipate that, obviously it's a five-way race, one of the candidates not very well known, but do you anticipate that they're going to try, the other candidates are going to kind of try and play that same game that Mamdani was so successful of in the primary?
I mean, again, from a social media perspective, Zoran was great. Now, after the primary, Cuomo comes out with a video of him jumping a car.
Yeah.
I mean, the video wasn't even filmed vertical. The video was filmed horizontal. And he's jumping a car. And it's like, you're running for mayor of New York City. Like, a lot of people don't use cars here.
Right.
So it's like, you got to get with the program. I saw a video this morning. Gail Brewer. Did you see the Councilmember Gail Brewer video?
I saw it. No.
She's holding an ice cream cone. And she's like, I'm Councilmember Gail Brewer. And I love ice cream. And then she talks about the ice cream truck was parked in the bike lane. Okay. But it was like a cute video.
A cute way
like
to get
Gail
into it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's got to be something a little more natural that flows nicely. I'd like to see more of that on social media. I mean, there's another candidate, Joseph Hernandez. He's running as an independent candidate for mayor. He's been less publicized of all the candidates, but he's there on the campaign finance board. I went to his apartment. We did a Cribs tour.
Yeah.
2 days later, maybe it was
a throwback to that MTV show.
Yes, MTV Cribs.
Yeah, from the 90s.
Maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe it wasn't. But 2 days later, Eric Adams posted a Cribs video of him walking around.
An homage to MTV. I saw that.
Yeah.
Funny.
I invite any candidate to allow me to do an apartment tour of their homes as well.
All right. We are out of time. We're going to leave it there. Sky, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Lobbying Insider Podcast is a production of Davidoff Hutcher & Citron LLP, New York State's premier middle market law firm, practicing in more than 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and government affairs. The podcast is produced by Don Tesserero, and our platform manager is Monica Thomas. Be sure to subscribe, and you can get it where you get most podcasts, including Apple, Audible, Google, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Thanks for being with us.